Part 1, Chapter 7. Jim stayed moody and silent for a week. As Atticus had once advised me to do, I tried to climb into Jim's skin and walk around in it. If I had gone alone to the Radley place at 2 in the morning, my funeral would have been held the next afternoon. So I left Jim alone and tried not to bother him. School started. The second grade was as bad as the first, only worse. They still flashed cards at you and wouldn't let you read or write. Miss Caroline's progress next door could be estimated by the frequency of laughter. However, the usual crew had flunked the first grade again and were helpful in keeping order. The only thing good about the second grade was that this year I had to stay as late as Jim, and we usually walked home together at 3 o'clock. One afternoon, when we were crossing the schoolyard toward home, Jim suddenly said, "There's something I didn't tell you." As this was his first complete sentence in several days, I encouraged him. "About what?" "About that night." "You never told me anything about that night," I said. Jim waved my words away as if fanning gnats. He was silent for a while, and then he said, "When I went back for my britches, they were all in a tangle. When I was getting them out, I couldn't get them loose. When I went back," Jim took a deep breath, "when I went back, they were folded across the fence like they were expecting me." "Across and something else." Jim's voice was flat. "Show you when we get home." They'd been sewed up, not like a lady sewed them, like something I'd try to do, all crooked, almost like somebody knew you were coming back for them. Jim shuddered, like somebody was reading my mind, like somebody could tell I was gonna do it. "Can't anybody tell what I'm gonna do lest they know me? Can they, Scout?" Jim's question was an appeal. I reassured him. "Can't anybody tell what you're gonna do lest they live in the house with you? And even I can't tell sometimes." We were walking past our tree, and its knothole rested a ball of gray twine. "Don't take it, Jim," I said. "This is somebody's hiding place." "I don't think so, Scout." "Yes, it is. Somebody like Walter Cunningham comes down here every recess and hides his things, and we come along and take them from him. Listen, let's leave it and wait a couple days. If it ain't gone, then we'll take it, okay?" "Okay, you might be right," said Jim. "It must be some little kid's place, hides his things from the bigger folks. You know, it's only when school's in that we found things." "Yeah," I said, "but we never go by here in the summertime." We went home. Next morning, the twine was where we had left it. When it was still there on the third day, Jim pocketed it. From then on, we considered everything we found in the knot hole our property. The second grade was grim, but Jim assured me that the older I got, the better school would be, that he started off the same way, and it was not until one reached the sixth grade that one learned anything of value. The sixth grade seemed to please him from the beginning. He went through a brief Egyptian period that baffled me. He tried to walk flat a great deal, sticking one arm in front of him and one in the back of him, putting one foot behind the other. He declared Egyptians walked that way. I said if they did, I didn't see how they got anything done. But Jim said they accomplished more than the Americans ever did. They invented toilet paper and perpetual embalming and asked where would we be today if they hadn't. Atticus told me to delete the adjectives and I'd have the facts. There are no clearly defined seasons in South Alabama. Summer drifts into autumn, and autumn is sometimes never followed by winter, but turns to a days-old spring that melts into summer again. That fall was a long one, hardly cool enough for a light jacket. Jim and I were trotting in our orbit one mild October afternoon when our knothole stopped us again. Something white was inside this time. Jim let me do the honors. I pulled out two small images carved in soap. One was the figure of a boy, the other wore a crude dress. Before I remembered that there was no such thing as hoodooing, I shrieked and threw them down. Jim snatched them up. "What's the matter with you?" he yelled. He rubbed the figures free of red dust. "These are good," he said. "I've never seen any of these good." He held them down to me. They were almost perfect miniatures of two children. The boy had on shorts, and a shock of soapy hair fell to his eyebrows. I looked up at Jim. A point of straight brown hair kicked downwards from his part. I had never noticed it before. Jim looked from the girl doll to me. The girl doll wore bangs, so did I. "These are us," he said. "Who did 'em, you reckon?" "Who do we know around here who whittles?" he asked. "Mr. Avery." "Mr. Avery just does like this. I mean carves." Mr. Avery averaged a stick of stove wood per week. He honed it down to a toothpick and chewed it. "There's old Miss Stephanie Crawford's sweetheart," I said. "He carves all right, but he lives down the country. When would he ever pay any attention to us?" "Maybe he sits on the porch and looks at us instead of Miss Stephanie. If I was him, I would." Jim stared at me so long I asked what was the matter, but got nothing, Scout, for an answer. When we went home, Jim put the dolls in his trunk. Less than 2 weeks later, we found a whole package of chewing gum, which we enjoyed. The fact that everything on the Radley place was poison having slipped Jim's memory. The following week, the knothole yielded a tarnished metal. Jim showed it to Atticus, who said it was a spelling medal, that before we were born, the Macomb County schools had spelling contests and awarded medals to the winners. Atticus said someone must have lost it and had we asked around. Jim camel-kicked me when I tried to say where we had found it. Jim asked Atticus if he remembered anybody who ever won one, and Atticus said no. Our biggest prize appeared 4 days later. It was a pocket watch that wouldn't run on a chain with an aluminum knife. You reckon it's white gold, Jim? Don't know. I'll show it to Atticus. Atticus said it would probably be worth $10, knife, chain, and all, if it were new. Did you swap with somebody at school, he asked? Oh, no, sir. Jim pulled out his grandfather's watch that Atticus let him carry once a week if Jim were careful with it. On the days he carried the watch, Jim walked on eggs. Atticus, if it's all right with you, I'd rather have this one instead. Maybe I can fix it. When the new wore off his grandfather's watch and carrying it became a day's burdensome task, Jim no longer felt the necessity of ascertaining the hour every 5 minutes. He did a fair job, only one spring and two tiny pieces left over, but the watch would not run. Oh, he sighed, it'll never go. Scout? Huh? You reckon we ought to write a letter to whoever's leaving us these things? That'd be right nice, Jim. We can thank 'em. What's wrong? Jim was holding his ear, shaking his head from side to side. I don't get it. I just don't get it. I don't know why, Scout. He looked toward the living room. I've got a good mind to tell Atticus. No, I reckon not. I'll tell him for you. No, don't do that, Scout. Scout? What? He had been on the verge of telling me something all evening. His face would brighten and he would lean toward me. Then he would change his mind. He changed it again. Oh, nothing. Here. Let's write a letter. I pushed a tablet and pencil under his nose. Okay. Dear Mr. How do you know it's a man? I bet it's Miss Maudie. Been betting that for a long time. Miss Maudie can't chew gum? Jim broke into a grin. You know, she can talk real pretty sometimes. One time I asked her to have a chew and she said no thanks. That chewing gum cleaved to her palate and rendered her speechless, said Jim carefully. Doesn't that sound nice? Yeah, she can say nice things sometimes. She couldn't have a watch and chain anyway. Dear sir, said Jim, we appreciate everything which you have put into the tree for us. Yours very truly, Jeremy Atticus Finch. He won't know who you are if you sign it like that, Jim. Jim erased his name and wrote Jim Finch. I signed Jean Louise Finch, Scout, beneath it. Jim put the note in an envelope. Next morning, on the way to school, he ran ahead of me and stopped at the tree. Jim was facing me when he looked up, and I saw him go stark white. Scout! I ran to him. Someone had filled our knothole with cement. Don't you cry now, Scout. Don't cry. Don't you worry. He muttered at me all the way to school. When we went home for dinner, Jim bolted his food, ran to the porch, and stood on the steps. I followed him. Hasn't passed by yet, he said. Next day, Jim repeated his vigil and was rewarded. How do you do, Mr. Nathan, he said. Morning, Jim, Scout, said Mr. Radley as he went by. Mr. Radley, said Jim. Mr. Radley turned around. Mr. Radley, did you put cement in that hole in that tree down yonder? Yes, he said. I filled it up. Why'd you do it, sir? Tree's dying. You plug 'em with cement when they're sick. You ought to know that, Jim. Jim said nothing more about it until late afternoon. When we passed our tree, he gave it a meditative pat on its cement and remained deep in thought. He seemed to be working himself into a bad humor, so I kept my distance. As usual, we met Atticus coming home from work that evening. When we were at our steps, Jim said, Atticus, look down yonder at that tree, please, sir. What tree, son? The one on the corner of the Radley lot coming from school. Yes. Is that tree dying? Why, no, son, I don't think so. Look at the leaves. They're all green and full. No brown patches anywhere. It ain't even sick. That tree's as healthy as you are, Jim. Why? Mr. Nathan Radley said it was dying. Well, maybe it is. I'm sure Mr. Radley knows more about his trees than we do. Atticus left us on the porch. Jim leaned on a pillar, rubbing his shoulders against it. Do you itch, Jim? I asked as politely as I could. He didn't answer. Come on in, Jim, I said. After a while. He stood there until nightfall, and I waited for him. When we went in the house, I saw he had been crying. His face was dirty in the right places, but I thought it odd that I had not heard him. Chapter 8. For reasons unfathomable to the most experienced prophets in Macomb County, autumn turned to winter that year. We had 2 weeks of the coldest weather since 1885, Atticus said. Mr. Avery said it was written on the Rosetta Stone that when children disobeyed their parents, smoked cigarettes, and made war on each other, the seasons would change. Jim and I were burdened with the guilt of contributing to the aberrations of nature, thereby causing unhappiness to our neighbors and discomfort to ourselves. Old Mrs. Radley died that winter, but her death caused hardly a ripple. The neighborhood seldom saw her, except when she watered her cannas. Jim and I decided that Boo had got her at last, but when Atticus returned from the Radley house, he said she died of natural causes, to our disappointment. "Ask him," Jim whispered. "You ask him. You're the oldest. That's why you ought to ask him." "Atticus," I said, "did you see Mr. Arthur?" Atticus looked sternly around his newspaper at me. "I did not." Jim restrained me from further questions. He said Atticus was still tushish about us and the Radleys, and it wouldn't do to push him any. Jim had a notion that Atticus thought our activities that night last summer were not solely confined to strip poker. Jim had no firm basis for his ideas. He said it was merely a twitch. Next morning, I awoke, looked out the window, and nearly died of fright. My screams brought Atticus from his bathroom, half-shaven. "The world's in an Atticus. Please do something." I dragged him to the window and pointed. "No, it's not," he said. "It's snowing." Jim asked Atticus, would it keep up? Jim had never seen snow either, but he knew what it was. Atticus said he didn't know any more about snow than Jim did. "I think, though, if it's watery like that, it'll turn to rain." The telephone rang, and Atticus left the breakfast table to answer it. "That was Eula May," he said when he returned. I quote, "As it has not snowed in Macomb County since 1885, there will be no school today." Eula May was Macomb's leading telephone operator. She was entrusted with issuing public announcements, wedding invitations, setting off the fire siren, and giving first aid instructions when Dr. Reynolds was away. When Atticus finally called us to order and bade us look at our plates instead of out the windows, Jim asked, "How do you make a snowman?" "I haven't the slightest idea," said Atticus. "I don't want you all to be disappointed, but I doubt if there'll be enough snow for a snowball even." Calpurnia came in and said she thought it was sticking. When we ran to the backyard, it was covered with a feeble layer of soggy snow. "We shouldn't walk about in it," said Jim. "Look, every step you take's wasting it." I looked back at my mushy footprints. Jim said if we waited until it snowed some more, we could scrape it all up for a snowman. I stuck out my tongue and caught a fat flake. It burned. "Jim, it's hot." "No, it ain't. It's so cold it burns. Now don't eat it, Scout. You're wasting it. Let it come down." "But I want to walk in it." "I know what. We can go walk over at Miss Maudie's." Jim hopped across the front yard. I followed in his tracks. When we were on the sidewalk in front of Miss Maudie's, Mr. Avery accosted us. He had a pink face and a big stomach below his belt. "See what you've done," he said. "Hasn't snowed in Macomb since Appomattox. It's bad children like you makes the seasons change." I wondered if Mr. Avery knew how hopefully we had watched last summer for him to repeat his performance, and reflected that if this was our reward, there was something to say for sin. I did not wonder where Mr. Avery gathered his meteorological statistics. They came straight from the Rosetta Stone. "Jim Finch, you Jim Finch! Miss Maudie's calling you, Jim. You all stay in the middle of the yard. There's some thrift buried under the snow near the porch. Don't step on it." "Yes, I'm called, Jim." "It's beautiful, ain't it, Miss Maudie?" "Beautiful, my hind foot. If it freezes tonight, it'll kill off all my azaleas." Miss Maudie's old sun hat glistened with snow crystals. She was bending over some small bushes, wrapping them in burlap bags. Jim asked her what she was doing that for. "Keep 'em warm," she said. "How can flowers keep warm? They don't circulate." "I cannot answer that question, Jim Finch. All I know is if it freezes tonight, these plants will freeze, so you cover 'em up. Is that clear?" "Yes, I'm Miss Maudie." "What, sir?" "Could Scout and me borrow some of your snow?" "Heavens alive, take it all. There's an old peach basket under the house. Haul it off in that." Miss Maudie's eyes narrowed. "Jim Finch, what are you going to do with my snow?" "You'll see," said Jim, and we transferred as much snow as we could from Miss Maudie's yard to ours, a slushy operation. "What are we going to do, Jim?" I asked. "You'll see," he said. "Now get the basket and haul all the snow you can rake up from the backyard to the front. Walk back in your tracks, though," he cautioned. "Are we going to have a snow baby, Jim?" "No, a real snowman. Gotta work hard now." Jim ran to the backyard, produced the garden hoe, and began digging quickly behind the woodpile, placing any worms he found to one side. He went in the house, returned with a laundry hamper, filled it with earth, and carried it to the front yard. When we had 5 baskets of earth and 2 baskets of snow, Jim said we were ready to begin. "Don't you think this is kind of a mess?" I asked. "Looks messy now, but it won't later," he said. Jim scooped up an armful of dirt, patted it onto the mound, on which he added another load and another until he had constructed a torso. "Jim, I never heard of a nigger snowman," I said. "He won't be black long," he grunted. Jim procured some peach tree switches from the backyard, plaited them, and bent them into bones to be covered with dirt. "He looks like Stephanie Crawford with her hands on her hips," I said, "fat in the middle and little bitty arms." "I'll make 'em bigger." Jim sloshed water over the mud man and added more dirt. He looked thoughtfully at it for a moment, then he molded a big stomach below the figure's waistline. Jim glanced at me, his eyes twinkling. "Mr. Avery's sort of shaped like a snowman, ain't he?" Jim scooped up some snow and began plastering it on. He permitted me to cover only the back, saving the public parts for himself. Gradually, Mr. Avery turned white. Using bits of wood for eyes, nose, mouth, and buttons, Jim succeeded in making Mr. Avery look cross. A stick of stove wood completed the picture. Jim stepped back and viewed his creation. "It's lovely, Jim," I said. "Looks almost like he'd talk to you." "It is, ain't it?" he said shyly. We could not wait for Atticus to come home for dinner, but called and said we had a big surprise for him. He seemed surprised when he saw most of the backyard in the front yard, but he said we had done a Jim Dandy job. "I didn't know how you were going to do it," he said to Jim, "but from now on I'll never worry about what'll become of you, son. You always have an idea." Jim's ears reddened from Atticus's compliment, but he looked sharply when he saw Atticus stepping back. Atticus squinted at the snowman a while. He grinned, then laughed. "Son, I can't tell what you're going to be, an engineer, a lawyer, or a portrait painter. You've perpetrated a near libel here in the front yard. We've got to disguise this fellow." Atticus suggested that Jim hone down his creation's front a little, swap a broom for the stove wood, and put an apron on him. Jim explained that if he did, the snowman would become muddy and cease to be a snowman. "I don't care what you do, so long as you do something," said Atticus. "You can't go around making caricatures of the neighbors." "Ain't a caricature," said Jim. "It looks just like him." "Mr. Avery might not think so." "I know what," said Jim. He raced across the street, disappeared into Miss Maud's backyard, and returned triumphant. He stuck her sun hat on the snowman's head and jammed her hedge clippers into the crook of her arm. Atticus said that would be fine. Miss Maudie opened her front door and came out on the porch. She looked across the street at us. Suddenly she grinned. "Jim Finch," she called. "You devil, bring me back my hat, sir." Jim looked up at Atticus, who shook his head. "She's dis-fussing," he said. "She's really impressed with your accomplishments." Atticus strolled over to Miss Maudie's sidewalk, where they engaged in an arm-waving conversation, the only phrase of which I caught was, "Erected an absolute morphidite in that yard. Atticus, you'll never raise him." The snow stopped in the afternoon, the temperature dropped, and by nightfall, Mr. Avery's direct predictions came true. Calpurnia kept every fireplace in the house blazing, but we were cold. When Atticus came home that evening, he said we were in for it and asked Calpurnia if she wanted to stay with us for the night. Calpurnia glanced up at the high ceilings and long windows and said she thought she'd be warmer at her house. Atticus drove her home in the car. Before I went to sleep, Atticus put more coal on the fire in my room. He said the thermometer registered 16, that it was the coldest night in his memory, and that our snowman outside was frozen solid. Minutes later, it seemed, I was awakened by someone shaking me. Atticus's overcoat was spread across me. "Is it morning already?" "Baby, get up." Atticus was holding out my bathrobe and coat. "Put your robe on first," he said. Jim was standing beside Atticus, groggy and tousled. He was holding his overcoat closed at the neck. His other hand was jammed into his pocket. He looked strangely overweight. "Hurry, hon," said Atticus. "Here's your shoes and socks." Stupidly, I put them on. "Is it morning?" "No, it's a little after 1. Hurry now." That something was wrong finally got through to me. "What's the matter?" By then, he did not have to tell me. Just as the birds know where to go when it rains, I knew when there was trouble in our street. Soft taffeta-like sounds and muffled scurrying sounds filled me with hopeless dread. "Whose is it?" "Miss Maudie's, hon," said Atticus gently. At the front door, we saw fire spewing from Miss Maudie's dining room windows. As if to confirm what we saw, the town's fire siren wailed up the scale to a treble pitch and remained there screaming. "It's gone, ain't it?" moaned Jim. "I expect so," said Atticus. "Now listen, both of you. Go down and stand in front of the Radley place. Keep out of the way, do you hear? See which way the wind's blowing." Oh, said Jim. Atticus, reckon we ought to start moving the furniture out? Not yet, son. Do as I tell you. Run now. Take care of Scout, you hear? And don't let her out of your sight. With a push, Atticus started us toward the Radley front gate. We stood watching the street fill with men and cars while the fire silently devoured Miss Maudie's house. Why don't they hurry? Why don't they hurry? Muttered Jim. We saw why. The old fire truck, killed by the cold, was being pushed from town by a crowd of men. When the men attached its hose to a hydrant, the hose burst and water shot up, tinkling down on the pavement. Oh, Lord, Jim. Jim put his arm around me. Hush, Scout, he said. It ain't time to worry yet. I'll let you know when. The men of Maycomb, in all degrees of dress and undress, took furniture from Miss Maudie's house to a yard across the street. I saw Atticus carrying Miss Maudie's heavy oak rocking chair and thought it sensible of him to save what she valued most. Sometimes we heard shouts. Then Mr. Avery's face appeared in an upstairs window. He pushed a mattress out the window into the street and threw down furniture until men shouted, "Come down from there, Dick! The stairs are going! Get out of there, Mr. Avery!" Mr. Avery began climbing through the window. "Scout, he's stuck!" breathed Jim. "Oh, God!" Mr. Avery was wedged tightly. I buried my head under Jim's arm and didn't look again until Jim cried, "He got loose, Scout! He's all right!" I looked up to see Mr. Avery cross the upstairs porch. He swung his legs over the railing and was sliding down a pillar when he slipped. He fell, yelled, and hit Miss Maudie's shrubbery. Suddenly, I noticed that the men were backing away from Miss Maudie's house, moving down the street toward us. They were no longer carrying furniture. The fire was well into the second floor and had eaten its way to the roof. Window frames were black against a vivid orange center. "Jim, it looks like a pumpkin." "Scout, look!" Smoke was rolling off our house and Miss Rachel's house like a fog off a riverbank, and men were pulling hoses toward them. Behind us, the fire truck from Abbotsville screamed in the curve around the curve and stopped in front of our house. "That book," I said. "What?" said Jim. "That Tom Swift book. It ain't mine. It's Dill's." "Don't worry, Scout. It ain't time to worry yet," said Jim. He pointed. "Look a yonder." In a group of neighbors, Atticus was standing with his hands in his overcoat pockets. He might have been watching a football game. Miss Maudie was beside him. "See there? He's not worried yet." "Why ain't he on top of one of the houses?" "He's too old. He'd break his neck." "You think we ought to make him get our stuff out?" "Let's don't pester him. He'll know when it's time," said Jim. The Abbotsville fire truck began pumping water on our house. A man on the roof pointed to places that needed it most. I watched our absolute morphidite go black and crumble. Miss Maudie's sun hat settled on top of the heap. I could not see her hedge clippers. In the heap between our house, Miss Rachel's, and Miss Maudie's, the men had long ago shed coats and bathrobes. They worked in pajama tops and nightshirts stuffed into their pants. But I became aware that I was slowly freezing where I stood. Jim tried to keep me warm, but his arm was not enough. I pulled free of it and clutched my shoulders. By dancing a little, I could feel my feet. Another fire truck appeared and stopped in front of Miss Stephanie Crawford's. There was no fire hydrant for another hose, and the men tried to soak her house with hand extinguishers. Miss Maudie's tin roof quelled the flames. Roaring, the house collapsed. Fire gushed everywhere, followed by a flurry of blankets from men on top of adjacent houses, beating out sparks and burning chunks of wood. It was dawn before the men began to leave, first one by one, then in groups. They pushed the Maycomb fire truck back to town. The Abbotsville truck departed. The third one remained. We found out the next day it had come from Clark's Ferry, 60 miles away. Jim and I slid across the street. Miss Maudie was staring at the smoking black hole in our yard, and Atticus shook his head to tell us she did not want to talk. He led us home, holding on to our shoulders to cross the icy street. He said Miss Maudie would stay with Miss Stephanie for the time being. "Anybody want some hot chocolate?" he asked. I shuddered when Atticus started a fire in the kitchen stove. As we drank our cocoa, I noticed Atticus looking at me, first with curiosity, then with sternness. "I thought I told you and Jim to stay put," he said. "Why, we did. We stayed." "Then whose blanket is that?"
"Blanket?"
"Yes, ma'am, blanket. It isn't ours." I looked down and found myself clutching a brown woolen blanket I was wearing around my shoulders, squaw fashion. "Atticus, I don't know, sir. I turned to Jim for an answer, but Jim was even more bewildered than I. He said he didn't know how it got there. We did exactly as Atticus had told us. We stood down by the Radley gate, away from everybody. We didn't move an inch. Jim stopped. Mr. Nathan was at the fire, he babbled. I saw him. He was tugging that mattress. Atticus, I swear.
That's all right, son, Atticus grinned slowly. Looks like all of Maycomb was out tonight, in one way or another. Jim, there's some wrapping paper in the pantry, I think. Go get it, and will... Atticus, no, sir. Jim seemed to have lost his mind. He began pouring out our secrets right and left in total disregard for my safety, if not for his own, omitting nothing, not whole pants and all. Mr. Nathan put cement in that tree, Atticus, and he did it to stop us from finding things. He's crazy, I reckon, like they say, but Atticus, I swear to God, he ain't ever harmed us. He ain't ever hurt us. He could have cut my throat from ear to ear that night, but he tried to mend my pants instead. He ain't ever hurt us, Atticus. Atticus said, "Whoa, son," so gently that I was greatly heartened. It was obvious that he had not followed a word Jim said, for all Atticus said was, "You're right. We'd better keep this and the blanket to ourselves. Some day, maybe, Scout can thank him for covering her up." "Thank who?" I asked. "Boo Radley. You were so busy looking at the fire, you didn't know it when he put the blanket around you." My stomach turned to water, and I nearly threw up when Jim held out the blanket and crept toward me. He sneaked out of the house, turned around, sneaked up, and went like this. Atticus said dryly, "Do not let this inspire you to further glory, Jeremy." Jim scowled. "I ain't gonna do nothing to him." But I watched the spark of fresh adventure leave his eyes. "Just think, Scout," he said. "If you'd just turned around, you'd have seen him." Calpurnia woke us at noon. Atticus had said we need not go to school that day. We'd learn nothing after no sleep. Calpurnia said for us to try and clean up the front yard. Miss Maudie's sun hat was suspended in a thin layer of ice like a fly in an amber, and we had to dig under the dirt for her hedge clippers. We found her in her backyard, gazing at her frozen, charred azaleas. "We're bringing back your things, Miss Maudie," said Jim. "We're awful sorry." Miss Maudie looked around, and the shadow of her old grin crossed her face. "Always wanted a smaller house, Jim Finch. Gives me more yard. Just think, I'll have more room for my azaleas now." "You ain't grieving, Miss Maudie?" I asked, surprised. Atticus said her house was nearly all she had. "Grieving, child? Why, I hated that old cow barn. Thought of setting fire to it 100 times myself, except they'd lock me up." "But—" "Don't you worry about me, Jean Louise Finch. There are ways of doing things you don't know about. Why, I'll build me a little house and take me a couple of roomers, and gracious, I'll have the finest yard in Alabama. Those bell and grass will look plain puny when I get started." Jim and I looked at each other. "How'd it catch Miss Maudie?" I asked. "I don't know, Jim. Probably the flu in the kitchen. I kept a fire in there last night for my potted plants. Hear you had some unexpected company last night, Miss Jean Louise."
"How'd you know?"
"Atticus told me on his way to town this morning. Tell you the truth, I'd like to have been with you, and I'd have had sense enough to turn around, too."
Miss Maudie puzzled me. With most of her possessions gone and her beloved yard a shambles, she took a lively and cordial interest in Jim and my affairs. She must have seen my perplexity. She said, "Only thing I worried about last night was all the danger and commotion that it caused. This whole neighborhood could have gone up. Mr. Avery'll be in bed for a week. He's right stove up. He's too old to do things like that, and I told him so. Soon as I can get my hands clean and when Stephanie Crawford's not looking, I'll make him a laying cake. That Stephanie's been after my recipe for 30 years, and if she thinks I'll give it to her just because I'm staying with her, she's got another thing coming."
I reflected that if Miss Maudie broke down and gave it to her, Miss Stephanie couldn't follow it anyway. Miss Maudie had once let me see it, among other things. The recipe called for 1 large cup of sugar. It was a still day. The air was so cold and clear, we heard the courthouse clock clank, rattle, and strain before it struck the hour. Miss Maudie's nose was a color I had never seen before, and I inquired about it. "I've been out here since 6 o'clock," she said. "Should be frozen by now." She held up her hands. A network of tiny lines crisscrossed her palms, brown with dirt and dried blood. "You've ruined 'em," said Jim. "Why don't you get a colored man?" There was no note of sacrifice in his voice when he added, "Or Scout and me, we can help you." Miss Maudie said, "Thank you, sir, but you've got a job of your own over there." She pointed to our yard. "You mean the Morphidite?" I asked. "Shoot, we can rake him up in a jiffy." Miss Maudie stared down at me, her lips moving silently. Suddenly, she put her hands to her head and whooped. When we left her, she was still chuckling. Jim said he didn't know what was the matter with her. That was just Miss Maudie. Thanks for listening. Be sure to hit that subscribe button below or click on the picture up above to subscribe to my channel so that I can make more of these audiobooks.